Okay, so we're starting Mesha Chachma, Parshas Re'e. I'm introducing for the second time. It's Mesha Chachma, Parshas Re'e. Page Tav Chaf Aleph. I wanted to start with the first piece. We are at the beginning of the Parsha. Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Lamed Aleph. Ki atem ofrim es hayardein lovo l'reshes es ha'oretz. Behold, you are crossing over the Yarden to come into the land which Hashem is giving to you. You should possess it and you should settle in it. Right? So this, plus a similar pasuk at the end of Bamidbar, again, you should possess the land and settle in it. Right? The Ramban, in the famous comments to the Sefer HaMitzvos of the Rambam, writes that this is the source for the mitzvah of Yeshivas Eretz Yisrael, of possessing and living in Eretz Yisrael. Major, major discussion. The Rambam omits any notion in his Sefer HaMitzvos that there is a mitzvah to settle Eretz Yisrael, thus probably serving as the best basis halachically for all of our actions. In other words, the fact that we're holding the shiur in the Lower East Side, holy though the Lower East Side is, not quite the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. You know, the notion, the simple chat of the Rambam seems to be that there is no mitzvah, or certainly no mitzvah chiyuvis, no absolute obligation to live in Eretz Yisrael. The way Rav Moshe puts it in one of his tshuvas is that although there's, you know, no mitzvah, there is a mitzvah chiyuvis, if a person does live in Eretz Yisrael, it's not the same as living in Hoboken. You know, it is considered to be a fulfillment of a mitzvah, but nonetheless, the way the Rambam understands the notion of living in Eretz Yisrael is that it's a nice thing, it's a positive thing, but it's not an absolute obligation, hence the fact that the Rambam doesn't count it among the 613 mitzvahs. The Ramban very famously argues, and the Ramban says, what are you talking about? It's a mitzvah saseh to conquer the land of Israel and to settle in the land of Israel. And the psukim, or again, the pasuk we mentioned at the end of Bamidbar, Baharashtem esaretz vishavtem bo, you should possess the land and settle it. And our pasuk over here, Virishtem osa vishavtem bo, possess the land and dwell in it. Right? So, you know, for the Ramban, this pasuk is a very, very important one, and establishes the notion of there being a mitzvah to actually go and live in Eretz Yisrael. Bar Adam v'chidushov, Toma, my time, I think it's supposed to be, it's a mistake, it's a mem test. My time on this Ava Moshe, another mistake, lichnos l'eretz Yisrael, har be mitzvos ve miskayim el ba'aretz. Right? Yeah, no, so I think it's all a printing mistake. I mean, Mikomachim is a printing mistake, Moshe is a printing mistake, it's Moshe, right, you know. But again, the Gemara in Sota is raised as a kasha on the sheet of the Rambam. Right? The Rambam says that Yeshivas Eretz Yisrael, coming to Eretz Yisrael and settling it and conquering it, is considered to be a mitzvah. But wait a minute. There's a Gemara in Sota, a famous Gemara at the end of the first parak in Sota, that asks the following question. Rabbi Simloy asks the following question. He says, why was Moshe so anxious to go into Eretz Yisrael? V'chilechom ipiryu hutzorich. What, he had a hankering for Jaffa oranges, you know, he was really that anxious to eat of the fruit of Eretz Yisrael. Well, what was driving Moshe Rabbeinu so much to go into Eretz Yisrael? So explains the Gemara, because he wanted to go in and fulfill the mitzvahs hatzliyas for Eretz. He wanted to fulfill Truma and Meiser and all of the various mitzvahs that can only be fulfilled in Eretz Yisrael, and to receive the schar, to receive the reward for those mitzvahs. So wait a minute. So if indeed, according to the Ramban, there's a mitzvah of settling Eretz Yisrael, a mitzvah to make Aliyah, the Gemara should have a simple answer to its question. What do you mean? He wanted to go in to fulfill the mitzvah of Truma and Meiser and Shemitah and Yovel. He wanted to go in because there's a mitzvah to make Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. Right? Isn't that the simple answer to the question? So one can ask against the Rambam, and I guess this seems to serve as a raya, as a proof to the Rambam, that, you know, the Gemara seems to indicate by its silence that there is no independent mitzvah to go in and settle Eretz Yisrael. There's no mitzvah really to make Aliyah. you know, the once you're in Eretz Yisrael, you have the opportunity to do many mitzvahs which you would not be able to do in Chutz La'aretz. But the fact that the Gemara doesn't, you know, if there's a mitzvah to make Aliyah, the answer to the question, why was Moshe so anxious to go into Eretz Yisrael, is a no-brainer. He was anxious to go into Eretz Yisrael because there's a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. Why does the Gemara see that right away, and why doesn't the Gemara answer that according to the Ramban? V'lo kasha midi. So says the Meshech Chachma, I don't think this is a kasha against the Ramban. Right, let me ask you another question. B'nei God and B'nei Ruve, right, decide that they want to settle down on the eastern side of the Jordan River. Right, so Moshe Rabbeinu yells at them, you're abandoning the rest of the people, you know, you're going to settle down over here and everyone else is going to have to go fight, you know, for their portion of Eretz Yisrael, right, a whole tirade. And they say, no, that's not true, we're going to go and fight, Nachum Avor Chalutzim, you know, we're going to go first. We're going to go and we're going to fight with everybody else. Oh, so Moshe Rabbeinu says, really? Oh, okay, well, if you're going to go fight, so because of the hate, you know, take this land on the eastern side of the Jordan and go, go fight for us. That's fine, not a problem. What do you mean, not a problem? Why didn't he have a taina to them that they're being mevatel the mitzvah saseh, that they're ignoring and trampling on the positive mitzvah of settling in Eretz Yisrael? If there's a mitzvah to make Aliyah, it's worse, you know. I mean, it's one thing, you know, you're born in America, and you know, the notion of shawarma just doesn't, you know, appeal to you in quite the same way that it appeals to other people, you know. So you say, look, I can't give up my pickles, I can't give up my pastrami. I feel that I have to stay in the Chutz La'aretz. Okay, so that's one madrega. But if the whole rest of the Jewish people is going in there, it's a show. And you say, no, I want to stay on the eastern side of the Jordan. Right? Okay, so maybe Jabotinsky is your hero, I don't know. But you know, the fact that you want to stay on the eastern side of the Jordan and be mevatel the mitzvah saseh of Yeshivas Eretz Yisrael, who gave B'nai Reuven and B'nai Gad the right to ignore what, according to the Ramban, is a mitzvah? Right? How did they have the right to do that? And why did Moshe Rabbeinu give them a hard time? You know, why was the only condition that they have to join the army and then they can go back and live in Chutz La'aretz? For Vadai ain't okay. Certainly, it's not true, says the Meshech Chachma, that B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven were ignoring the mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. The kimu gam be'eretz Sichon ve'og mitzvah zo. Because anyone who lives in land conquered from Sichon and Og is also fulfilling the mitzvah of Yeshivas Eretz Yisrael. Remember, how did the land that B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven lived in was land that originally was controlled by Sichon and Og, who were two Amorite kings, and the Amorim, you know, from whom Sichon and Og came, were one of the Shiva Amorim. They were one of the seven nations who inhabited the greater Eretz Yisrael. Shezeu ha'emori ma'asha omar v'arash demesores v'shavtim ba. What's this pasuk saying? The pasuk that's over here that speaks of the conquest of Eretz Yisrael. The pasuk speaks of the conquest of Eretz Yisrael from the hands of the seven nations. So Mimela says to Meshech Chachma, any land which used to belong to the seven nations, which is part of the greater geographical area of Eretz Yisrael, which is then conquered by the Jewish people, is Eretz Yisrael for the purposes of the mitzvah of making Aliyah.
So basically it's an extension of Eretz Yisrael.
It is. It's part of Eretz Yisrael, essentially. In other words, when B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven settle on the eastern side of the Jordan, they're not in Chutz La'aretz. Right? Sorry? Right. And, now again, you know, there are certain halachas that don't apply in Chutz La'aretz. You know, the Omer L'mashal has to be brought from the western side of the Jordan. The Shnei Alechem has to come from the western side of the Jordan. You know, Eber HaYarden doesn't have all of the halachas of Eretz Yisrael down to the last count. But, says the Meshech Chachma, with regard to the mitzvah of making Aliyah, or the mitzvah of Kibush HaAretz, of conquering Eretz Yisrael, the lands that used to belong to the Emori on the eastern side of the Jordan certainly fall into that category. They certainly are subject to the mitzvah of Kibush and Yeshivas Eretz Yisrael. So B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven were living in Eretz Yisrael. You know, the only taina that Moshe Rabbeinu had to them is, you know, how are you going to let everybody else go to war and you'll sit and establish cities in this in this part of Eretz Yisrael that you know everybody else fought for. But once they say no, we're gonna go and participate in the war, and in fact go in the head of the line, you know, and put ourselves in danger. And on behalf of the rest of the Jewish people, the fact that they're living in Eiver Hayarden, you know, doesn't bother Moshe Rabbeinu in terms of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. V'imkein madua hoya Moshe mevakesh l'knos la'aretz, v'adai kol zman shlo hoya kibush v'chiluk la'aretz, hoya mekayim bin bozeh yeshivas Eretz Yisrael, v'zeh poshut. Right? So therefore, says the Meshech Chochma, that's why Moshe Rabbeinu, in the Gemara in Sota, you know, the Gemara in Sota does not say that Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to go into Eretz Yisrael in order to fulfill the mitzvah of Yeshivas Eretz Yisrael, because already there, you know, even before he crossed over the Jordan, right, even before the Jewish people crossed onto the western side of the Jordan, just by being in the land conquered from Sichon and Og, Moshe Rabbeinu was already in fulfillment of the mitzvah of Yeshivas Eretz Yisrael by virtue of dwelling in lands that had been conquered from the Emorim, from Sichon and Og. Right? So that's an interesting chiddush which the Meshech Chochma puts out over here, you know, that Eiver HaYarden is considered to be part of Eretz Yisrael with regard to the halachas of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael as well.
Why don't you say that the only reason why Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to go into Eretz Yisrael, even if you say it's not a mitzvah issue, it's Eretz Yisrael, but right, the fact that we always say every day that the Rebbe should give so many mitzvahs, well, it's not that it's a rabbi.
Right.
So maybe this is what he wants, because I have the chance to do more mitzvahs.
No, that's what the Gemara says. The Gemara says he wanted to be Mekayim mitzvah of Truma and Meiser. So Moshe Chochma, though, was asking a better answer. You know, he wanted to go into Eretz Yisrael to be Mekayim mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And it's you know, it's a more fundamental thing. Forget about Trumas and Maisa, this mitzvah, that mitzvah. The very act of going in is a mitzvah. So that's what Meshach Chacham wants to say. That's not true. And Moshe Rabbeinu was in fulfillment of that mitzvah of Yeshivas Eretz Yisrael already in the Eiver HaYarden, as he wouldn't have gained that by going into Eretz Yisrael.
So at the same time, if we're saying that Yeshivas Eretz Yisrael is a mitzvah, right, those people that are in there already,
fine.
So therefore, conversely, if they leave, then maybe you read that it should be in a Averim.
In a Chidam. I'm not saying Levaisa, but you know, the concept of leaving Eretz Yisrael once you're there already is not so far.
Because it's near a lot of someone's in that way, alone on Yiftim and Eretz Yisrael, you know,
that would bring them out of Eretz Yisrael. 100%. I mean, but even beyond that, even leaving Eretz Yisrael, there was just to take two examples thereof, the Briska Rav, you know, who started off like Chutzal Eretz, made it a point that he and his descendants would never leave Eretz Yisrael, you know, for anything. And, you know, they held that halacha. Once we're in Eretz Yisrael, we're here. You know, we're not taking any vacations in Switzerland or fundraising or anything of that nature. We're in Eretz Yisrael. You're not allowed to leave. Right? It was, over the past 2 years, it was actually a big tumult among some of the rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael. You know, one of the programs that's become very popular over the past couple of years is something, you know, something run along the lines of March of the Living, right? You know, the idea that high school students will be brought, you know, to Auschwitz, you know, to Poland, you know, to see the various camps, and then ultimately to Eretz Yisrael. So the Israeli high schools have a similar kind of program, you know, where they'll go, they'll see, you know, Eastern Europe, and then they'll come back to Eretz Yisrael. So a number of years ago, registered complaints with this whole idea of the program. Number one, they said, hashkaftically, why should we bring them back to Poland? You know, why do we have to support the Polish government with our dollars? You know, when we go, and, you know, anytime you take a trip anywhere, you feed the local economy. Why should we do that? But besides the Ashkenazic grounds, they said, halachically, who says it's a poshut to take a bunch of people out of Eretz Yisrael just for, you know, for touring? Right? Now, again, that's not the common practice. People, even living in Eretz Yisrael, leave Eretz Yisrael for all kinds of reasons. But if you look in the black and white, the halacha, it's not so simple to pick up and leave Eretz Yisrael when you're living there. You know, there have to be reasons, you know, that justify the person leaving, right? Is the sea, meaning the Mediterranean?
Along the coast.
Maybe along the coast. Oh, you're saying like that? I think along the coast probably would be considered
Eretz Yisrael.
Right. So probably when, you know, the shelf drops off, I assume. You get far. That's what I would think, or fear. In other words, you know, the coast of a country, I think, is considered to be part of the country. You know.
Right.
Continental.
Coast.
Yeah. Right. There's a Gemara in Gittin Daf Ches where it talks about a boat which is out in the water outside of Eretz Yisrael, and whether, you know, the stuff, you know, the plant stuff inside of the boat, whether it's hiding from the Samaisers, you know, so it's probably, again, I don't have it off the top of my head, but if you look in that sugya over there, that's probably where you'd look to figure out, you know, where how far the border of Eretz Yisrael extends, you know, in terms of the coast. Okay, at the bottom of Tov Days, a second piece, a longer piece, the Shechachma elaborates at length on a Yesod, an idea which we saw already earlier this year. He mentions it in passing in Parshas Pekudei, right? But here he develops this idea much more at length and shows how it works to explain numerous different episodes that take place in Tanakh. Lo satsun kechol ha-shanachu osim po ayom ish kol ha-yosher be'enof. Like the Pasuk says, you shouldn't, when you come into Eretz Yisrael, you shouldn't do all of the things that we do here today, everyone doing whatever is fine and good in his own eyes. What does that mean? So if you look in Rashi, the beginning of the parasha, Rashi spells out that in the Midbar, let me backtrack a little bit. Says Rashi, at various points during the Jewish history, bamos were either aser or mutter. In other words, the notion that you could bring a karbon outside of the Mishkan or the Beis Hamikdash, at certain points that was permissible, at certain points that was not permissible. When was it permissible? So when the Mishkan first stood in Gilgal, when the Jews came into Eretz Yisrael, and later on when the Mishkan was in Nov, and then afterwards in Givon, it was permissible, you know, to bring karbanos on bamos, on private altars, outside of the Mishkan itself. However, when the Mishkan stood in Shiloh, as it did for most of the period of the, basically all of the period of the Shoftim, right? And when the Mishkan, and when the Beis HaMikdash later was built in Yerushalayim, right? During those periods of time, the period of Shiloh, the period of Yerushalayim, the bamos became osur. Right? It was prohibited to offer up a karbon outside of the environs of the Mishkan or the Beis HaMikdash. And Rashi explains that when the Pasuk talks about the beginning of this week's parasha, Kilo vasem el ha-menucha v'el ha-nachala, you have not yet come to the menucha, the rest, and the nachala, the inheritance. What the Pasuk means to say is that when you do come to the menucha, to Shiloh, or when you do come to the nachala, to Yerushalayim, that homecoming, so to speak, you know, the erection of the Mishkan at Shiloh, the building of the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, is going to prohibit the bringing of karbanos anywhere else on any kind of bomb. Right? That's, we assume, again, that Mishnah Tzvachim spells this out, and this is what we assume, that Shiloh and Yerushalayim create an Isser for bamos outside of those places. So, with that in mind, says the Meshech Chachma, actually, Echad Milom De Lemed. So, a learned person asked me the following kasha. Yishoftim Perek Beis says, let's take a look in Sefer Shoftim, in the very, very beginning of Sefer Shoftim, Perek Beis. It says that Vayal Malach Hashem min haGilgal el haBochim. Right, a Malach came, a messenger from God. In this case, it's a Navi. A Navi comes to the people from Gilgal, and he comes to a place called Bochim, and he tells them that you, the Jewish people, are not listening to what you swore that you would do to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem said, "Lo sichu supris liyoshvei haaretz hazos." You should not make a covenant, a peace treaty with the inhabitants of this land. "Lo shematem bekoli." You didn't listen to me. "Mazos asisem." What have you done? "V'gam amarti lo agarish osam ipnechem." So since you have made a covenant with the people of the land and you haven't destroyed their avodah zaros, so says Hashem, so I'm not going to drive out the inhabitants of the land. I'm going to allow the Canaanim to remain there. They will be a source of difficulty for you. They will be thorns in your side. And their gods will be a snare for you. When the Novi says these things to the people, they begin to cry. And they call the name of that place where they begin to cry, Bochim, the place of crying. And they bring karbanos to Hashem, I guess is a way of expressing their sorrow, their bad feelings over the fact that, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu basically feels that they let him down. So comes this learned person to the Meshe Chochma and he asks him as follows. This whole incident takes place after Yoshua has died. Like Sefer Shoftim opens up after the death of Yoshua, and indeed it says that as long as Yoshua was alive, the people were firm in their commitment to Hashem. So the very notion that a Navi would come to the Jewish people and tell them, you're backsliding, you're not following the right thing, you're worshipping Avodah Zarah, you're not driving out, you're not destroying the Avodah Zarahs in the land, that whole kind of discussion would take place after the death of Yoshua. Yoshua chai chok ches shana. So let's do a little bit of math over here. The time that the Jewish people came into Eretz Yisrael, it was 28 years that Yoshua lived after the entry into Eretz Yisrael. Now Mishkan b'Shilo, who come take him after Yudal Shana Shikip Shubachalku? When was the Mishkan set up at Shilo? 14 years, right, after the Jews came into Eretz Yisrael. The Jews were conquering Eretz Yisrael for 7 years. They were busy dividing up and settling Eretz Yisrael for another 7 years. At the end of that total of 14 years, that's when the Mishkan was erected in Shiloh, as the Pasuk in Yoshua tells us. Kama shekasuv Yoshua perek yudches, vayikaru kol hadas bnei Yisrael Shiloh, vayashkanu sham es olel moed. It says, that the Jewish people set up the Mishkan, the olel moed, in Shiloh. That's described to us in Sefer Yoshua. Right? So the Mishkan is set up in Shiloh 14 years after the Jews come into Eretz Yisrael. Yoshua himself is alive for another 14 years after that, right? Then he dies. And then this episode described at the beginning of Sefer Shoftim, where the Navi comes to the Jewish people in Bochim, castigates them, they cry, and they bring karbanos in Bochim. That takes place at least 28 years after the Jews have come into Eretz Yisrael, at least 14 years after the Mishkan has been erected in Shiloh. So this learned person asked the Meshe Chochma, so how is this halachically permissible, what happened here in the Pasuk in Shoftim? How are the people allowed to bring karbanos in Bochim, which is not in Shiloh, wherever it is exactly, it's not in Shiloh, it's not describing how they're going to the Mishkan and bringing karbanos. How are they able to bring karbanos outside of the Mishkan in Shiloh if bamos are usur when the Mishkan is in Shiloh? Right? In Cain, right, 2 lines from the bottom, Oz hayu avamos asurim. Ve'ech zavchu bibolchim Hashem. So how were they able to bring karbanos? So in other words, the halachas that we know don't fit in with the story as told in the Navi. So how is that permissible? V'zeh kushya atzuma. Right? This is a gevaldig kasha, says the Meshe Chochma. Basically, you have all the facts staring you in the face, but they don't add up. Right? If the Mishkan was already in Shiloh, if it had been in Shiloh already for 14 years at that point, what gave them the right to offer karbanos? The Pasuk is against the Mishnah and Tzvachim and everything that we know. By the way, as the Meshe Chochma, Tosef is Dir Mishali. This was not exactly his kasha. He has something kind of like this, but I fixed it up a little bit. Says the Meshe Chochma. I polished it up, but it's a kabbalah. After I got through with it, it's a kabbalah kasha, says the Meshe Chochma. Hey Shavti, so this was my teretz, says the Meshe Chochma. Ki itzuk tosef tosof tzvachim. Ezu bamos gedola b'shas heter abamos. The Tosefta writes at the end of Masechta Tzvachim, what is considered to be a Bama Gedola that at the time that the Bamos are Mutter? Pirush. He explains. Pirush. Emosai ve'echaisa Bama Gedola Ashir b'shvil ze'hoyu ha'bamos mutarin. What would be a case where there is a Bama Gedola, meaning a central place of worship, which nonetheless allows the creation of private Bamos? The Bama Gedola generally is the reference to the Mishkan, right? So how could you have the Mishkan erected in such a way that private Bamos would be Mutter? So he goes back to quoting the Tosefta. If Ohel Moed Notui Kedarko, right? If the Ohel Moed is set up in its normal fashion, the Ha'aron Lo Hayo Nosun Shom, but the Aron was not placed in the Ohel Moed, Lochain Havamos Mutarin. In such a case, the Bamos would be Mutter. And he goes on to say that he says in the parentheses a little bit earlier, When the Mishkan was set up in Nov and Givon, the Aron was not there. Again, let's just chazer over the history a little bit. The Aron, the Mishkan was in Shiloh up until the war that's described with the Plishtim, the war with the Plishtim that's described at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, where the Aron was captured. When the Plishtim took the Aron, they also destroyed the Mishkan in Shiloh. And it was at that time that the Mishkan moved to Nov and then subsequently to Givon. The Aron was in captivity. While the Mishkan was moved to Nov and then to Givon, Uveis Oved Edom, and when the Aron was returned, it sat in the house of Oved Edom for many years, and then Kiryas Yearim, and then Yerushalayim. The whole time that the Mishkan was erected in Nov and then later in Givon, the Aron was never present there. So the fact that the Mishkan was set up, but the Aron was not there, is what allowed the Bamos to be Mutter. Aval b'shilo hayu ha'aron be'oel moed, v'lochach hayu ha'bamos asurin. The reason that bamos were asur when the Mishkan was erected in Shiloh is because the Aron was present in the Mishkan in Shiloh, and it wasn't so much that it was a question of Shiloh versus no forgiveness. In Shiloh, the Aron was present in the oel moed in the Mishkan. The presence of the oel in the Mishkan was what asurred the bamos all around Eretz Yisrael. Right, that's Sefirush HaTosefta. This is what the Tosefta means. The Hag of the Gilgal Hayu Habamos Mutaros. So basically, so far the Meshech Chachma has explained based on the Tosefta the following thing. Right? Why is it that by Nov and Givon the Bamos were Mutter? Because the Aron wasn't in the Mishkan. When the Aron was in the Mishkan by Shiva, or later in the Beis Hamikdash, the presence of the Aron is what acted the Bamos. So by Gilgal, for the first 14 years that the Jews were in Eretz Yisrael, before they set up the Mishkan in Shiloh, the Mishkan was in Gilgal. And so why were the Bamos Mutter at that point? So he goes on to explain, V'hadu v'Gilgal, hayu Bamos Mutaros, v'shum d'lo nachum mikibush nachala. That had to do with a different reason, because the Jews had not yet finished conquering the land. Well, the Omer v'zochim k'lobosom al-ato el-hamenucha, d'nachum mikibush. Right? They had not yet conquered the land entirely during those first 14 years. So even though the Aron was in Gilgal during that period of time, he assumes, nonetheless, the fact that things were in flux, the land was still being conquered, meant that Bamos were not going to be awesome. He named Isa Zed the Bochim, Haya Atari Mos Yoshua. Let me ask the Kenu Sha'avdu Es Hashem, Kuwa Shapir Sham Lepashim. Basically, it says, let's try to date this episode that takes place at the beginning of Sefer Shoftim, this episode that takes place in Bochim. It was apparently right after, the death of Yoshua. Now, if we look at the very end of Sefer Yoshua, where, the last assembly that Yeshua calls right before his death is described. It describes how the people come to Shechem by Yisyasru lifnei ho'elokim, as they stand before God. What does it mean that they stand before God? So the Meshech Chachman interprets, they brought the Arrow to Shechem. Right? That's what it means, they stood before God. Not from Shiloh, it's before Shiloh. I'm sorry, guys. This is very soon after they have moved the Mishkan to Shiloh. Right? You're right. Very soon after they have moved the Mishkan to Shiloh. But this final discussion that I'm sorry, 14 years, right? 14 years after the Mishkan has been moved to Shiloh, now Yoshua is about to die, right? So they take the Aron from Shiloh to Shechem, right? That's what the Pasuk means when it describes that the people stood with Neho Elokim before God. I mean, otherwise, what does it mean that they stood before God? You know, what it is. And he says that's borne out further by the following pasuk. In that same parak, the pasuk Chavav, it says, "Vayichtav Yoshua Sadvarim O'Ele, the sacred Taras Elokim." Right? Yoshua writes down these words, which and he places them together with the sacred Torah. Vayikach Ev. Now, by the way, where's the Sefer Torah that we're talking about? This is the Sefer Torah which is next to the Aron. It was the Sefer Torah Moshe Rabbeinu had written down, which was, you know, adjacent to the Aron. Vayikach Evan Gedola Vayikimeh Hashem Tachas Ha'Allah Asher B'Mikdosh Hashem. He takes a large stone and he sets it up there, you know, next to the Aron which he has brought to Shechem together with the Sefer Torah which is next to the Aron. So in other words, the Aron at this point is in Shechem at the very end of his life. Im kein haya oz ha'aron b'shechem v'haya ha'oel moe k'din v'ama g'dolo v'haya v'amos mutarim v'lachach zav chusha v'bochim v'ashem v'zeh boru. Right? So the Meshech Chochma offers up an incredible chiddush. He says that at that point the Aron was moved to Shechem and apparently stayed in Shechem for a certain period of time thereafter. They didn't just take out the Aron from the Mishkan in Shiloh and bring it to Shechem for a day and then move it back. Sounds like they had the Aron in Shechem together with this great rock, which was a symbol of the covenant they had entered into. They had the Aron in Shechem for an extended period of time. When Yoshua died, the Aron was still in Shechem. And when this episode in Bochim takes place at the beginning of Sefer Shoftim, the Aron is still in Shechem. Now, if the Aron is in Shechem, says the Meshech Chachma, so then even though the Mishkan is in Shiloh, the fact that the Aron is not in the Mishkan allows Bamos outside of the Mishkan. So now we can understand how they were able to bring Karbanos at the beginning of Sefer Shoftim after this episode in Bochim, because the Aron wasn't in the Mishkan at that particular point. It's not a function of Shiloh versus no forgiveness. It's a function of where is the Aron. If the Aron at this point is outside of the Mishkan, so then that allows the Karbanos to be brought, the Bamos to be erected outside of the Mishkan Shiloh.
Why was this laxity? Why was this tolerated? The Mishkan is here, the Aron is there. Why not put the Aron where it belongs?
Right, so I don't think it's a laxity. I think, you know, the way the Meshech Chochma at least understands, they brought the Aron to Shechem, you know, because they wanted to make a covenant with the people in Shechem. Right? You know, Yoshua wants to bring the people back to Shechem. Shechem has historic significance for the Jewish people. He wanted to make the covenant in Shechem.
Right?
But once they had made the covenant there, so they set up a great stone that was a witness to the covenant. Apparently they kept the Aron there also as a witness to this covenant which had taken place. You know, I guess Shechem was maybe more accessible to the people than Shiloh, whatever it was. I assume the Aron wasn't just kind of sitting out there in the rain. You know, I'm sure they made a tent over it, they protected it, you know, they took care of it. But Lemaisa, they thought it was important to have the Aron there by the marker that signified the bris that had been made between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the Jewish people. Right? So, you know, they were not married to this idea that the Aron has to be in the Mishkan at all times. They thought that as a symbol of the bris. Remember, it's called the Aron HaBris. As a symbol of the bris, it was appropriate to move it to Shechem.
So, Yoshua fortress, what changes 14 years later when the Aron is placed back?
Okay, so let's take it through Jewish history at this point, right? What he proceeds to do. So in other words, starting there from the end of the life of Yehoshua, there's already this split between the Mishkan and the Aron. They're not in the same place. Consider the following. I'm sorry. Yeah, sure. Yeah. There is no Aron. Right. Right, so it's interesting. Bomos are also, you know, once the first Beis Hamikdash is built, the Isser becomes an Isser Olamis. Even between the Churban, even between the Mikdash, the Mikdashos, right? As even during the 70 years between Bayis Rishon and Bayis Sheni, he still can't build Bomos, right? Because that there's a special halacha with regard to Bayis, you know, to the Beis Hamikdash. Once the Beis Hamikdash is built, it assers the Bomos forever and ever. Right, so it's even forget about the Aron not being there. Who wants the Beis Hamikdash is not there anymore. You know, during that interim period of Churban, the Bamos is still going to be Asa. That's a special halach. You know, once you come to the Nachala, you know, so then the Bamos become Asa forever and ever. Right, Yeah, well, the Gemara there in Megillah has two opinions about whether that was. First of all, there's one opinion that says it was a Beis Avodah Zarah, you know. So that for sure, you know, is Aser. And you know, even if it was a Bayis Lashem, you know, it's disputed as to whether that was a good thing or a bad thing. You know, whether it was permissible, right? Whether it was permissible, right? Right. I mean, the simple pshat, you know, most Shittos seem to hold. The Gemara actually says in Megillah, if you take a look in the first Perek, that, you know, maybe the Gemara tries to defend that practice, you know, the Beis Chonya, and then the Gemara ends up saying, no, the truth is really indefensible, because again, once the Beis HaMikdash is built, the Bamos become also forever and ever. And it's, the Kedusha generated by the Beis HaMikdash is considered to be an everlasting Kedusha, you know, and even its physical absence still asks the Bamos afterwards. So, Borei Amitas Novrezek, I'll consider the truth of this thing, I'll show it to you. The Kapitel Chof, right, you look a little bit later on in Sefer Shoftim, in Perek Chof, B'mochemes Yisrael b'nyomen k'siv, v'yasu k'vene Yisrael v'yavol, u'beisel, v'yalu olos u'shlom l'fnei Hashem. Right, the war that takes place between Binyamin and the rest of the Jewish people, after the gruesome episode of the Pilegesh Begiva, you know, the concubine who is raped and ultimately dies and sparks the civil war between the Jewish people, between Yisrael, you know, the rest of the Jewish people, and Shevet Binyamin. It says that, you know, the rest of the Jewish people came to Beis El and they brought karbanos. So Nachamo, you have the same kasha again. Harei de Beis El, ikrivo olos ushlamim. Right? They brought karbanos in Beis El. So what gave them the right to bring karbanos in Beis El? Again, you know, the Mishkan is already set up in Shiloh. Right? Let's just get the pasuk. Vayalakol b'nei Yisrael, it's Pasuk Chavav, in Perichof and Shoftim. Vayalakol b'nei Yisrael, v'chol ha'om, v'yavo, Beis El. They all come up, they go to Beis El, v'yivku, v'yeshu, shom l'fnei Hashem. They cry, they sit there before God. V'yotsumu v'yom ahu an ha'arev. They fast that day until the evening. Vayalu olos u'shlomim l'fnei Hashem. Right? And they bring up karbanos on that, you know, before Hashem at that time. How were they able to bring karbanos? So says Meshachach, but the answer is actually the next pasuk in Shoftim. Vayishalu b'nei Yisrael b'Hashem. So b'nei Yisrael ask the wisdom of Hashem, how should they fight the war? How do they do that? V'sham aron briso elokim b'yom imohen. Because the aron was there in Beis El in those days, so they were able to ask, you know, in the presence of the Aron, they were able to, you know, ask as an oracle of sorts. You know, they were able to come to the Ribbono Shel Olam and ask, what's our next move? Right? So the Aron is there in Beis El. during this period of time. Bishum diksiv tekef, ayishalu b'nei Yisrael v'Hashem v'shom arom b'Yisrael elokim v'yom o'hem, harei ha'da oron ha'ya oz b'veisel, v'lochach ha'yu mutar n'habomus v'ayu makrib v'shom b'veisel k'din b'omas yachid. So that's what allowed them to bring karbonos in Beisel, the presence of the Aron there in Beisel. Ki b'seder olam amu ki ha'chub de b'pilegesh b'giva ha'yu b'imei kushan v'shosayim, v'ayu oz Yerushalayim b'lo ishbe b'nei Yisrael, k'ma sha'omar lo nosur alir nachri, b'zeh ha'yu samuch l'mos Yoshua. The Seder Olam says that this whole Maisa with the Pilegesh Begiva, even though it's related, you know, very, very late in Sefer Shoftim, it actually takes place in the early days of the Shoftim, not long after the death of Yoshua. So apparently, again, we're not given all the details, but apparently the Aron was set up for a period of time in Shechem, and apparently not long after that it was moved from Shechem to Beisel. They still didn't see that it was appropriate to move it back to Shiloh. Right? The Aron was in Beisel, so when the Jewish people came to Beisel, you know, that's when they were able to bring karbonos, and they were actually able to, you know, to daven in the presence of the Aron and to ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu for guidance. Yerushalayim was off the radar screens. Yerushalayim was controlled by the Yevusim up until the time of David HaMelech. Yerushalayim wasn't even on the radar screen from the point of view of the Jewish people. Right? Now, how did the Aron get to Beisel? So he goes on, he says, I'll trace that as well. Let's go back to Shoftim Perek Aleph. He's giving us a little lesson in Navi over here, right? Go back to Shoftim Perek Aleph, where it describes immediately after the death of Yoshua, how the various Shvatim are going out and conquering different parts of Eretz Yisrael. So in Shoftim Perek Aleph, it says, Bayalu Beis Yosef Kamhein Beis El, the children, you know, the members of Shevet Yosef, Menashe and Ephraim, went up to Beis El, Vashem Imam, and Hashem was with them. They came to Beis El, and, you know, the descendants of Yosef conquered Beis El, you know, from the Knaanim who dwelled there. Okay, that's what it says in Sefer Shoftim. Ask the Meshech Chochma, what's the meaning of the two words Vashem Imam, and Hashem was with them? So the simple pshat is, they were victorious. You know, God was on their side. Says Meshech Chochma, no, that's not what it means. I mean, they won. Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you read the psukim, you can figure out if they won, God was on their side. It means the Aron was with them, because they took the Aron into war, as we see constantly. That's what got them into trouble with the war in the Plishtim. They eventually. And that, you know, finally they took it into war, they lost the war, the Aron was captured. But up until that time, it was a pretty good strategy. In other words, they would take the Aron with them into war, and the Aron would help them win the war, right? And that's apparently what happened over here as well. The Bnei Yosef took the Aron into war with them when they went to Beis El. They were victorious, right? And that's the Meshech Chochma writes, Ki l'dayti te'ushu ki hoya ha'aron itam, v'zeo Hashem imam, sha'aron hu mishkanah. So they go to Beis El, they conquer Beis El with the help of the Aron being with them, and apparently they decided that this was, you know, such an incredible success that we should leave the Aron here in Beis El, set up the dwelling place of the Aron here in Beis El. Beis El, after all, means the house of God. It seems like an appropriate place to set up the Aron. So from that time on, the Aron was in Beis El. For us, Hayahuvdo the Pilegesh Begiva, and it was soon after that that the Maisa with Pilegesh Begiva happened. So, in other words, for a very extended period of time, the Aron was not together with the Mishkan. It was set up in various places. Apparently, it was only somewhat later in time that the Jewish people made the decision, you know what, we've got this Mishkan, we've got this Aron, it kind of makes sense to put them together, to put the Aron into the place where the Mishkan is. But it wasn't like such an obvious thing for a certain period in history that the Aron necessarily would have to be in the same place as the Mishkan.
You say clearly Luther to take the Aron to war with you? In other words, they had this experience with the ship, the Aron was captured. Now they're repeating this in the case of Beisel.
No, but just get the chronology. In other words, the Maisa with the Plishtim is hundreds of years later. That's the beginning of Sefer Shmuel.
Yes.
And the truth is, that's the first time and the only time that it doesn't work. Meaning, up until that time, it sounds like they've been very successful taking the Aron with them into battle. Hashem himself told the Jewish people when they crossed the Yarden, or when they went to conquer Jericho, go take the Aro and use it as a way of, you know, being successful in battle.
So wasn't there special handling, so to speak, required? Like, Rabbi Melech, he's singing while this is being carried in Yerushalayim.
Like Uzzah dies, right.
She disparages it or something to that effect. So on the one hand, in my limited understanding, there's special handling of this war. On the other hand, you're going to war where there's a... might be captured or damaged, perfectly
fine. Right, but again, you know, the story with the Plishtim is the one, the exception which apparently proves the rule. That was the last time they did this, and that just showed that, you know, that was a terrible mishap. Up until that time, the very idea of carrying the Aron was what gave them success. And, you know, they apparently were not worried about damaging it or destroying it, because, no, if the Aron's with us, we're invincible. Well, Dabka could take it with us into battle, because that will enable us to win. And so, the notion seems to have been that the Aron and the Mishkan did not have to be linked together. That which we take as a double culture, that where's the right place for the Aron within the Mishkan, that apparently was not true. In other words, they did not assume that as a double culture. The Aron was in Shechem at the end of the reign, at the end of the time of Yoshua. Early in the time of the Shoftim, they took it with them to Beisel. And it seems that it was only later that it was actually brought back to Shiloh. And the impression he had from the war with the Plishtim is that maybe periodically they took it out of Shiloh in order to go and fight their wars. You know, there wasn't this assumption that you have to just leave the Aron put. If that's the case, if there were periods, long periods of time, where the Mishkan was in Shiloh and yet the Aron was not there, so that would explain why the Balmos are mutter in all of those circumstances. Because the Balmos are only usher during the period of time that the Mishkan is in Shiloh, and the Aron is in the Mishkan in Shiloh. If the Aron is out, you know, like they had a big traffic light outside the Mishkan in Shiloh, you know, the Aron is in, the Aron is out. If the Aron is out, you know, so then you can go bring a carbon on your private Bama, you know, so then all bets are off. Right? So, again, it's a fascinating treatment of, you know, the halacha and the history. It puts it all together in a very, very beautiful way. He was miramis to this idea. Again, if you look back at the beginning of Parshas Pekudei, he told us that, you know, the beginning of Parshas Pekudei describes the Mishkan as Mishkan Ho'edus. Right? What's Mishkan Ho'edus, the tent of testimony? So the Shachachma explained that the Mishkan only really has its full power as a Mishkan when the Edus, the Luchos, the Aron, are inside of it. That's what it's really called, a Mishkan. A Mishkan without the Edus is a Chassi Mishkan. You know, it's lacking in some way. In other words, it doesn't have the full, you know, capacity or full characteristics of a Mishkan, right? Witness the fact that when the Aron is outside of the Mishkan, the Balmos become Mutter. Right? So that idea he hinted at, you know, in the beginning of Parshas Pekudei, if you go back and take a look over there, but here he really develops it at length and explains how so much of the history that we have in Sefer Shoftim, you know, fits in with this idea. Okay. Just go forward a little bit. Go to the end of the parasha. Let's take a look on page Tov Lamed Beis, which is in the parasha of the Moadim. You know, the mention of the holidays, the Yom Tovim. That's at the end of Parshas Re'eh. Goes through the Shlosh Regalim. And in Perek Tes Zayin, Pasuk Beis, it describes how V'zovach lo Pesach L'Hashem Elokecha Tzon u'Bokor, you should offer up a Korban Pesach, you know, to Hashem. Where does the Korban Pesach have to be shechted? V'amokom asher yivchar Hashem l'shaken shemo shom. In the place where God chooses to cause to rest His name there, right? Beis Hamikdash, right? Mishkan Beis Hamikdash, right? Similarly, if you look in Perek, in that same Perek in Pasuk Yud Aleph, when it describes the Yom Tov of Shavuos, it says V'samachta lefnei Hashem Elokecha, you should rejoice before God. In the place where God chooses to have His name rest there. If you fast forward a little bit more in the Pasuk, That same parrot, Pasuk Tesvav, when it's described in the Yom Tov Sukkos, says, Shivas Yomim Tachog LaShem Elokecha, you should bring karbonos of Chagiga to Hashem for 7 days, you should celebrate for 7 days, Ba'amakom Asher Yivchar Hashem, in the place where Hashem chooses. Right? The three words which characterize the first two psukim, L'shakei Shmo Sham, to cause his name to rest there, are absent. It's very striking. I mean, you know, clearly it's the same phrase over and over again. You know, Ba'amakom Asher Yivchar Hashem, Elokecha, Ba'amakom Asher Yivchar Hashem. Right? Why is L'shakei Shmo Sham, to cause his name to rest there, mentioned in the first two instances, but when it comes to the discussion of Sukkot, where the idea is the same idea, there, those three words, L'shakim Shmo Shom, to have his name dwell there, those three words are omitted. Well, what is it?
This is a temporary dwelling.
Well, no, but here, we're not talking about the Sukkot, we're talking about the Beis HaMikdash. Right, so what? Why is it that the Beis HaMikdash, same place, is described slightly differently when it comes to Sukkot? So he says the following interesting idea. Pesach Vaseres, and Pesach and Shavuos, Yizkar Asher Yivchar L'Shakein Shmo Sham. Right, it mentions those three words, the place which God chooses in order to cause His name to rest or to dwell there. Uvasukos Nemar Asher Yivchar. And Sukkos, the pasuk simply says Asher Yivchar, the place which God chooses. Vokosu L'Shakein Shmo Sham. Near a time, so the reason would seem to relate back to the beginning of the parasha. The Berosh HaMarsha, the beginning of Parashat Tzrei, Kosov, and he tags them. It says you should break apart the idolatrous altars, you know, and the Avodah Zarahs of the nations that you're coming there. So, Losasun came, Ki im al-amokor ha-shivchar Hashem l'shakim shmo shom. Right? The nations, you know, the Canaanite nations, they build their altars wherever they want over Eretz Yisrael. You should destroy them. Don't do that to Hashem. Rather, you should have one centralized place. Go to the place, Hamakom Hashivchar Hashem L'Shakim Shmo Sham. Go to the place, again, that phrase, where God has caused His name to dwell there. So, says the Meshech Chochma, what the Pasuk over there seems to be driving at is the following. Mishum de'inim ha'avodah zara ha'yu l'horid ruchnius ha'kochavim el ha'tzura ha'mechuvenes uchmavu ha'akol b'divrei ha'ibn Ezra. L'chein Omer ki b'mikdash lo sechavnu lahori ruchni os shum mashpia ruchni o kolchav levad Hashem yisborach sheshochan shmo shom sheshochan shmo shom lishmo bilvod hamiyuchot. What's Avodah Zarah all about? So he says the notion of Avodah Zarah is that you tap into a particular star or a particular force in the world, and you try to harness its force for good for yourself. I think you see this most, again, you know, in our own experience. You read a little bit about the Native American religions, you know, where they worship the various aspects of nature. They were in touch with nature. Now that's very trendy, you know, to talk about that kind of stuff, right? But again, from my understanding, my limited understanding, you know, if you were a Native American, you know, a shaman or something of that nature, you would reach out to the power of the rain to bring rain into your life. You reach out to the power of the god of the corn crop, you know, to bring that power of the corn crop into your life. In other words, you would, you know, the worshiper would try to tap into the powers that are out there in the universe and to try to channel them, you know, down to the earth in some way, so that the worshipper would be able to benefit from those, you know, from those kochos, you know, from those forces. The Ovid Avodah Zarah, as we pointed out in a different context, didn't necessarily deny the existence of God. As many Ovid Avodah Zarah said, there is one God. There is a God up there. It's just that these other forces in nature are also powerful, and we can connect to them directly without asking. We don't have to ask God to help out the corn crop. We'll ask, you know, the force of the corn crop, you know, that power, the god of the corn, you know, to come and, you know, bestow his blessing upon the corn crop, and we'll turn to him directly. We don't have to talk to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we'll talk to the god of the corn. You know, we'll talk to the god of cats, you know, if we want cats, you know, whatever it happens to be. So the part in the beginning of the parasha says, Losasun kein Lashem Elokeichem. Destroy all of those altars of Avodah Zarah, You just want to have one place where it's God's place, l'shaken shmo shom. His name is there. You know, notice the Beis HaMikdash, there's only one number that you're allowed to dial in the Beis HaMikdash. Right? There are no extensions. Right? The old Avodah Zarah had a concept of extensions. You know, press one for corn, press two for rain, you know, press three for, you know, I don't know, for health, you know, whatever it happens to be. No, there's l'shaken shmo. His name and his name alone is associated with the Beis HaMikdash. You can't use the Beis HaMikdash as a spiritual conduit to channel any other type of force in the world other than Hashem Himself.
So, since the Rebbe Shalom is all over, why do you need Rebbe Shalom on sin? And this is the question I guess from the Rebbe Yeshaya and the Rosh Chodesh after I
don't know what you're doing. Right.
Why would we simple people imagine that Rebbe Shalom could be contained in this one unified place?
Right, so there are different answers to that. The most rationalistic answer, which I guess will suffice with the time being, is, I think, given by the Sefer Achinuch at length. If you look at the beginning of Parashas Truma, where the Sefer Achinuch discusses the mitzvah of building a Beis HaMikdash, the Sefer Achinuch basically asks the same question. What do we need this house for? You know, God's all over the place. So basically what the Sefer Achinuch there writes is, you're right, God doesn't need a house. God is all over the place. But we feel God's presence more acutely if we take a place and say, this is God's house. So it's easier for us to feel God when we go to that house. But you're right, God's everywhere. You know, we don't need a house to access God. It's just that we're gonna feel more religious and spiritual when we go to that place, right? So there are other answers as well. I mean, other answers say, no, there is a special notion of Kedusha. You know, Kedusha is not, everyone agrees it's Kedusha, but the Shaila is Kedusha just something because we feel the Kedusha, or somehow objectively, you know, God's presence is more here than it is in other places, however you define that exactly.
You never say it's made a matter of disciplining yourself.
Right, so the Sefer Achinuch really, again, my understanding of the Sefer Achinuch at least, is that it's really very subjective. I mean, you're right, HaKadosh Baruch Hu told us to build a house for Hashem because as human beings, we need some kind of central location. God doesn't need it. God's all over the place, you know. But for us, we need something that's going to inspire us. I mean, you know, look, you come to a shul, you daven, there's a different feeling you have. You connect to God in a little bit of a better way than if you're davening in a playroom. You know, I mean, it's true. It is what it is.
Can you say this? Maybe like many times it describes a bunch of yatatzoka. Does he have a hand? It's just something that we can relate to. The same thing, I think, if you have a central place, let's say, a basement or something, we can relate to it as this being...
So that's exactly the same for Achinuch's point. You know, in other words, this is for us. Right? Having said that, you know, one might have said, look, the Beis HaMikdash is a holy place. It's a place where we can channel all kinds of spiritual things. Why not channel the spirit of, the grace of mankind, you know. We'll channel the spirit of Moshe Rabbeinu and talk to Moshe Rabbeinu in the Beit HaMikdash. We'll channel, you know, the force of wind, you know, and relate to that force in some way. Certainly a pagan would have done that. You know, the pagan would have come and seen the Beit HaMikdash as a holy place where he can channel all kinds of things. No, says the Pasuk, you know, the Beit HaMikdash is only the Shaking Shmo. It's for God's name, you know, if you were to write it in English, the word His would be bolded. You know, it's the place where God chose to have His name rest there, and not any other deity, or any other force, or any other spiritual entity. You know, Beis HaMikdash is about relating to God, and to God alone. Right? So, I'm just going to skip the next four lines and just start on the top of page Tav Lamed Gimel, the fourth line. Lachain b'pesach v'atzeres nidona atulo peres o ilon yesh litos chalila hoyd ruchin yosinian acher zuas Hashem yisbarach. Mishnah in the beginning of Rosh Hashanah tells us that on Pesach, God judges the world in terms of how the crop of wheat is going to turn out, and on Shavuos, God judges the world in terms of how the crop of fruit is going to turn out. Right? So again, we're not so sensitive to these things because we're not farmers, but, you know, for a farmer, you know, Pesach rolled around, you're worrying about how the wheat harvest is going to go. And when Shavuos rolls around, you're wondering about how the fruit harvest is going to go. So you'd be naturally davening for these things at this time. And when the farmers were all Ola Rego, when they came up to the Beis HaMikdash, there was a tremendous temptation to daven, not necessarily to God, but to try to use perhaps other means to influence the result of the crops, you know, to influence the quality of the fruits. You know, again, it's hard for us to relate to this because we daven to the Ribbono Shel Olam. I don't think most of us in our mindset have a notion of trying to tap in to the, you know, to the God of kumquats, you know, in order to make the kumquat crop, you know, come out good, or, you know, the wheat god, you know, the wheat force in the nature. But again, if you were a pagan person coming from a pagan mentality, or even a Jew, you know, who's surrounded by all this kind of stuff, you might have the temptation going to the Beis HaMikdash around Pesach time to, you know, to direct your prayers towards, you know, the gods of wheat, you know, the gods of fruit, you know, that might be your temptation. So therefore the Pasuk has to stress, no, you're going to the place where God has called His name, you know, to be mentioned there. You daven to God, you don't daven to any intermediaries. So why by Sukkos? Why by Sukkos is that phrase omitted? So he says, hello? We know in Sukkos what's being contemplated up there in heaven. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was deciding whether the rainy season, which is now about to start with Sukkos, whether the rainy season is going to be successful, whether there's going to be rain this year. Even the pagans understood that for rain you have to go to the boss. You know, there's no rain god. Right? You know, you can't. There's no spirit which will help you bring down the rain. The rain, you know, is something that comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. Is there any, you know, power among the futile idols of the Goyim that bring down the rain? Right? The Gemara in Tainus famously says, right at the beginning of Tainus, that rain is one of the three keys that HaKadosh Baruch Hu possesses himself. Even the non-Jews, he said, even the pagans understood that when it comes to rain, you have to go to the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. You have to go all the way to the top. Right? So a Jew would never have a Hava Amina. He would never even think to address another power to try to get rain. Rain, you have to go to God. Right? So, therefore, on Sukkos, there's no need to say, L'shakein Shmo Shom. You know, that God caused His name to be in this place, in the Beis HaMikdash, because when it comes to water, you know, everybody understands that, you know, you would be davening to Hashem in the Beis HaMikdash and not to any other type of God. Perhaps we can say something a little bit different. I mean, again, just, you know, addressing the same phenomena that the Meshech Chochmah points out, but perhaps from a different point of view. Sukkos, besides being the culmination of the Shlosh Regalim, is also the end of the Yom Noroim period. Right? You know, it's Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkos is really, in a sense, it's the third, you know, the American Jew doesn't realize this, right? But in other words, you know, the High Holidays isn't over with Yom Kippur. The High Holidays run through Simchas Torah, you know, Sukkos is part of the High Holidays as well. You know, the seats are a little cheaper, but nonetheless, you know, Sukkos is the third, the triumvirate of the Yom Noroim. So, whereas when it comes to Pesach and Shavuos, a Jew may think that, you know, he may be led astray, he's not quite sure, you know, Havodah Zarah, this, you know, all the cheshbonos that the Meshech Chochmah talks about, by the time Sukkos rolls around, and the Jew has come so close to God through Rosh Hashanah, through Yom Kippur, he's purified himself in such a fashion, to the Jew it's obvious that the only one he would connect to in the Beis HaMikdash is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right? It's after the purification of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Remember, Yom Kippur, Ashreichem Yisrael Lifnei Mi Atem Mitarim. Right? A Jew realizes on Yom Kippur that he comes Lifnei Hashem. He comes in the presence of the HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. So by the time he gets to Sukkos, and he's coming right off the heels of Yom Kippur, there's no mistaking that the role of the Beis HaMikdash is a place where HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name in itself is connected to the Beis HaMikdash. She knows that intuitively. There's no need for the pasuk to make that explicit, you know, the way it does by Pesach and Shavuos.
What do we mean
Sukkos? Sorry?
What do we mean
Sukkos? Well, that's when he starts Sukkos. By the time Sukkos is over, he's been indulging already, and, you know, after Simchas Torah, you probably need Sukkos.
Hashem, like, Uri Kofi, you know,
had
been in charge of physical aspects of the Ark Kofi,
right.
Hashem Torah. Exactly what are we getting from the Sakish Moshav? Hashem channeled the light or whatever to other
right.
Jewish prophet or and ended up being Uta to the Star Amayu.
Right.
So, I mean, you say something.
Right. No. So although the kochos exist, right, and again I think the Ramchal writes in Derech Hashem, we don't really understand why God set up the world in this way. But God set up the world, you know, in such a way that there are kochos that are, you know, God does delegate, so to speak. You know, there are kochos that, you know, are involved in the various parts of the world. But nonetheless, our karbanos and our tefilos in the Beis HaMikdash are not directed to those kochos, but rather they're directed to Hashem. Right, so that's the Ramban points out that throughout Sefer Vayikra, you know, the karbanos are never being described as brought to Elokim. Right, the name which is used throughout Sefer Vayikra is Yudke Vavke, because there should be no Elokim is a fungible term. Elokim can mean gods, you know, lowercase g. Yudke Vavke is God, is, you know, Hashem Yisparach. Right, and you know, there should be no mistaking the karbanos are supposed to be brought to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And to HaKadosh Baruch Hu alone, even though the kochos exist, but we're not supposed to appeal to them, you know, in terms of our bringing of the karbanos. Right? So that's the idea I think we're just bringing out over here. You know, don't bring, especially when you come, Pesach Shavuos, don't lose sight of the fact that the karbanos is supposed to go to Hashem. By Sukkos, that's already obvious to you. You know, by Sukkos, no one would have a havam, you know, that you would offer the karbanos to anything other than HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not to his intermediaries or his subsidiaries. Okay, we'll stop over here and we'll pick up as Hashem next week.